Accession number 29958, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Brian Minchin, who's home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 22nd of the 2nd, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. I wanted to talk, if we could, about the raids that you would undertake in March of 45, but you were mentioning to me that there was a sort of diligence involved in dropping bombs as close to the target as you possibly could, and we discussed people that may not have and situations where people, you know, may have dropped them early or late. But my impression is that there was a concern for the civilian in all of this, you know, something that sort of isn't really thought of these days, I suppose, when you think of people going into drop bombs on somewhere like Afghanistan or something like
that.
Yes, a blanket raid.
Yes, well, and there's a very good experience. After the war, we did a trip over to Germany to see the devastation we'd created, that all the air forces had created during the war. And one particular city I remember was Cologne, where the cathedral, everything else around it was completely demolished, and the cathedral stood there, a little pockmarked, but as Buckingham Palace was, but also it was completely safe. So it was obvious that the people bombed the areas that were mainly bridges that were to affect communication, of course, was the main target there. But that's the reason. But the thing about it is that we all knew that the photographs that were taken as the bombs were released were printed back at the squadron, and of course they could theoretically show you exactly on the aiming where your aiming point was and whether you hit the target or not. So that was a discipline that was very important, and of course that kept people, pilots and crews, honest, because they knew that they just couldn't release the bombs anywhere, as I think we might have said earlier, where it's possible some people did get a little lack of moral fibre, which is understandable possibly, and just drop the bombs anywhere, which is would be a waste.
We obviously hear stories of places like Dresden where
the
devastation was total.
It was. But that was, of course, because, as you no doubt were aware, that the winds were so strong and incendiaries were used, and once the city caught fire, there was no stopping it because of the tremendous winds that were blowing that night, and the fire just spread and wiped the place completely off the map, really.
We often hear of bomber pilots explaining the distance that they have between the devastation and what they're doing, and the sort of the isolation of their job, and only afterwards do they realise what's been involved. But you voiced earlier this concern that the civilian population was thought about from thousands of feet up.
Yes, even though that was very important, some of us felt that because of the bombing in Britain, where London was devastated, and I know that the cathedral up at I can't remember the name of the cathedral that we visited after the war, but it was completely devastated, completely bombed and burnt out. So that, as happened no doubt with other churches and cathedrals in Great Britain, and therefore I think some people felt that that even if we did damage or if we did kill civilians, it wasn't done intentionally, and that possibly could have been some some retribution, I shouldn't say that, but retribution in view of the damage that was created by the Germans in London and elsewhere.
Well, this was war after war. I mean, it wasn't a cricket match.
That's right. Sure. But
although there have been comparisons made that you go to war almost the same way as you might go to a cricket match. In relation to the experience of flying high above a target, let's talk then about these bombing raids that you were involved with in March and discuss what was involved. How did the plane run as a well-oiled machine to begin with? Its crew, how did it work together to get you there and drop the load at the right place at the right time?
Well, when you received your crew, when you went to conversion unit converted onto the heavy bomber, you had quite a lot of practice bombing, and bearing in mind also that you had to do dinghy drill and escape drill regularly with your crew, whether you were flying or not flying. You had to do this so that the crew soon became, bearing in mind that they wanted to survive, and to survive they had to do their job properly as they were instructed and taught, and it didn't take long to meld a crew of seven into a team. And I think because of the exercises that we did during the conversion course, and then even on squadron, we would have to regularly do these exercises such as dinghy drill and escape drills.
I wanted to discuss the actual bombing raid themselves and what was involved in actually getting over the right point and dropping it at the right point.
Well, that's right. Well, for example, the next raid that we did was in April, early April, which was a raid on an oil refinery at Harburg-Renania in Germany. And this raid, like all raids, the pilot had a drawn map showing exactly the course that was to be flown to avoid fighters, if possible, and areas of heavy flak, and so you knew exactly where you had to go. And your navigator, of course, who gave you the courses to steer, you hoped he would be an expert at this, and you would get there, which we did in this particular case. But the problem is that if you have we talked about, I think, before, the amount of flak and the amount of searchlights. If you were combed in a searchlight, you were virtually going to get some damage from the flak, because once you were coned and you couldn't, especially if you're over the target, you couldn't do any evasive action or very little evasive action, because you had to keep a steady course, especially over the last matter of a half a mile run up to the target. So this was very important to make sure that the bombs were released accurately, was to be to fly very accurately and steadily on the course. And you had to obey the instructions from the master bomber. The master bomber was flying above the target for some hours, and he was dropping flares so that as depending on the wind speed at the ground level, these flares would drift off target. So they had to put different coloured flares down, and you would be instructed on which flares to bomb. And as long as they were accurate, you had a chance of getting somewhere near your target. So that was the main thing that you had, and of course you it was the target was usually lit up if you were not among the first to arrive there, which was most of our raids. We arrived when the operation was in full swing and the bombing was in full swing. You'd find that the target was well lit, but you had to make sure that you bombed on the specific coloured flare that was you were instructed by the master bomber.
Mm. You've been talking about going and bombing on bombing ranges on the Rhine at one point. Let's talk about those before we move on.
Yes, well, that was the Dortmund-Ems canal that we bombed. That was in the Ruhr Valley. As most probably some people wouldn't know, but the Ruhr was the main area where they manufactured all the weapons, guns, aircraft for the war effort in Germany. And so the barges that went down the Dortmund-Ems canal, they carried obviously large amounts of ammunition, guns, weapons, whatever you like to call them, and maybe tanks, so that for the war effort, so that it was very important that we were successful in demolishing these barges as they sailed down. Now this was a daylight raid, and so you could see pretty well the damage that was caused. But of course, by the same token, you could also see the thousands of bombs that were dropped along the banks of the Dortmund-Ems canal that were not close enough, and I would say that there'd be far more bombs dropped on the banks of the canal and in the canal that did no damage to any barges that were sailing down there. But that was the previous operation that we did was the Dortmund.
How had that gone? I mean, what was the resistance that you would face in a zone for the enemy?
The main thing you had to be aware of in daytime was were fighter aircraft, and your crew were all on the search, apart from the bomb aimer, were all searching the skies for any fighters. And the other thing, of course, was as the canal was fairly heavily defended with anti-aircraft guns, you had to beware of the flak. But fortunately, with the height we were flying, and as I said before, we were using what they call a silver paper to put off the anti-aircraft guns. They thought, of course, that an aircraft, every speck on the screen, their screen was an aircraft, when in effect there was only one in many thousands of pieces of metallic objects were floating down from the aircraft. And now, but after these initial raids, we went on leave. In fact, we went on leave before we went to the squadron. I should have told you that back on the January the 26th of 1945, when we were on leave, we went to the Boomerang Club, which was in Australia House at the top of Fleet Street and just at the end of the Strand, where the Boomerang Club was a club for all Australian servicemen in London, who came to London. And on this particular day, being Australia Day, the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester were in attendance at a variety concert. And this was quite an exciting event for Australians, especially on Australia Day. And the Duke and Duchess happened to mingle with the servicemen. I didn't happen to meet them, but we appreciated the fact that part of the royal family were there to support us when we were on leave in London. Now, the lady in charge of the volunteers at the Boomerang Club in Australia House was Marie McKinnon, who was a West Australian lady, who was the sister of the West Australian Agent General in London, a Mr. Troy. And she was very, very prone towards looking after West Australian visitors, and in fact, at one time she invited myself to her brother's residence for high tea one afternoon. And Mr. and Mrs. Troy were very, very delightful people, as Mary was, and we visited them. They were somewhere in the, not far from the tennis centre at
Wimbledon.
They lived nearby Wimbledon, and we travelled there with Mary, and were entertained at high tea at the Troy's residence. So those are the sort of happy memories we had. The other happy memories were at Australia House at the Boomerang Club. You could get the specialty there for servicemen was waffles with jam and cream. Now, I don't know where the cream came from, but we do know that obviously the Agent General must have had friends, dairy farming friends, because I'm sure the cream, some of the cream would have been directed to the club, and it was really a treat, because bearing in mind that food was rationed severely at that time of the war, and eggs and cream were virtually very difficult to come by. But that's some information on leave, taking our leave. The other time I should mention was when I got special leave for my brother's wedding. My brother was a flight lieutenant in the Royal Australian Air Force. I've mentioned him before, and I was to be his best man at his wedding at St. Simon Zelotes Church in Chelsea in London. And the night before the wedding, Ron and I stayed at a hotel not far from Chelsea, or nearby Chelsea, and it was quite an exciting night, because on that night we were both in bed, and it wasn't long before the siren sounded, and we smartly ducked under the bed, because with the buzz bombs, several buzz bombs came, and of course when they cut out, I think as I've mentioned before, it takes about 7 seconds for the bomb, for the small aircraft to hit the ground and the bomb to explode, and so the bed, under the bed, was the safest place that we could find. And not long after that, a V2 rocket, which is similar to the size of the rockets that, not quite as big as the rockets they send, Americans send their people to the moon and elsewhere these days, up into the higher atmosphere, but they were fairly large rockets, and they you had no warning of them, so that you were either alive or you were dead. If you were within 50 metres, I would say, of a rocket landing, you would be you would no longer be with us. And so we had a couple of buzz bombs that night. Usually the fighters shot them down before they got into central London, but two got through this night, and also a V1 rocket, which of course there was nothing to prevent their passage from Germany or the coastal areas of Germany to England, and they were a very, very nasty and damaging missile.
We were talking about your involvement, obviously, with operations in March and April, and we're coming to the very end of the war here.
Yeah.
But they were still sending over these buzz bombs and V2 rockets.
Yes. Yes.
Presumably, you must have known, being a bomber pilot, that things were looking pretty sticky for the Germans. But to have this still going on, how is that affecting the general populace, would you say?
Well, I'm certain it had a great adverse effect on the population, but bearing in mind that towards the end of the war, our fighter aircraft were shooting down a lot of these buzz bombs before they reached the city itself, and so bearing in mind that there weren't that the population, the residential population in London wasn't that great, and therefore, because I'm sure a large percentage of them, especially with children, moved well out of the area of Greater London, and so I don't think it affected morale to any great extent, and we all were well aware of how King George VI and his wife, the Queen Elizabeth, visited all these air raid at the aftermath of the air raids, and chatted with any residents who are around the area, and so I don't think it had any great effect. But obviously,
before we move on, let's talk about the raid between after the Ruhr experience that you would have. What were the raids that followed on from that?
Right,
you would be involved with.
Well, the next raid we had was a night raid, which would be quite a large, I don't know whether it was a 1,000 bomber raid. this raid was on an oil refinery at Harburg, Renania in Germany, and being a fairly, as I said, I'm not sure whether it was a 1,000 bomber raid, but it must have been a large number of aircraft taking part, because this was an important target. We were using somewhere around about 7,500 pounds of medium to heavy high explosives, and also a large number of incendiaries, so that once the oil was breached, the incendiaries would set alight to the oil. This raid was quite successful. There was fairly heavy flak, no night fighters, and we got a subsequently we ascertained that we got a good strike on the target, our aircraft, and the raid was successful. But as when we got back to you usually have a roundabout way of flying back to your target, mainly to avoid fighters and any flak that might be in certain heavy in certain areas. And as when we got towards base, we were diverted to Carnaby, Fido emergency landing drome on the coast of Yorkshire, and because all the landing spots around our squadron were totally immersed, 100% immersed in fog. And so Fido was a system whereby they had a pipeline down both sides of the drome which carried oil, and these were ignited, and that dispersed the fog, which enabled you to land safely at this base. And we had to stay overnight and return the next day to our base at Driffield. Now, one thing I saw there was a Lancaster that had, on the side of the runway, that had broken its back completely, and I'm not sure whether it was done on landing or whether the aircraft was badly damaged and limped back to base. But I do know that one of my old friends in the Air Force I met earlier was the pilot of that aircraft, and his name was Dan Conway, and I've got a photograph of this aircraft, and I keep I haven't seen him for many years, so if I could see him, I'd be asking him what I'd like to know the full story, because the answer could be quite interesting. Now, after that raid, we went on leave again, and Often on leave when we'd go to London, well, I'd either go down to the Dove family's farm at Mount Nessing, which is on the old Roman road, about 20 miles out of London, and there on the farm, there were, as I think I've told you before, there were three daughters and a young son. The girls were all mainly teenagers, and one girl I think was in her early 20s, and we used to drive the tractors, and they used to we used to have quite a lot of fun with the family on the farm. And I took the girls into London to the Strand Palace Hotel on the Strand for lunch. And those girls, even though they lived such a short distance from London, had never been into London, and their eyes were popping when they saw the head waiter directing us to our table, and the way the luncheon was served. I think it was a great culture shock to them, living on a farm with very few amenities during the war. And so that was quite an interesting episode in on my leaves. And also other leaves that we spent with, I've already mentioned the Macbeth family, who were at Petersfield, where we regularly went. But I also went to my bomb aimer, Laurie Goodburn was my bomb aimer, and his family at Barnsley in Yorkshire. We went on leave there and enjoyed their hospitality.
I'm interested to talk about the raids that you were involved with, and discuss what was involved with the build-up to these raids. And presumably, and you've talked about a couple in passing. Let's go back and literally talk about, okay, here you're being told you're off on a raid. Presumably only a matter of hours beforehand you know where you're actually going.
Mm-hmm.
What was involved on the aerodrome, on the
yes,
base, when
yeah.
you're gearing yourself up
yeah.
for what could potentially be
yes.
your last raid
yes,
ever?
That's right. Well, you had to attend, pilots had to attend a separate briefing, and navigators and bomb aimers another briefing. At the briefing, we were given the target and also the course to be followed, and you were issued with a map showing the course detailed on the map, and you were advised of where to expect light and or heavy flak, where you could expect to you'd need to keep a close lookout for fighters in other areas. And then you were told what the raid was about. As I said, with the Harburg Renania target, it was an oil refinery, and so it was important to know what you were going to bomb. In fact, the next raid that we did and were briefed for was the raid on the U-boat pens at Harburg. At Hamburg, I should say, in Germany, and so it was most important as the U-boats had been creating havoc to our shipping over the years of the war. It was important to keep rid the enemy of as many submarines as possible, and so it was in that raid we had about 8,000 pounds of only high explosive bombs, because we were told that the pens were protected by a number of feet of solid concrete, so that we had to penetrate these concrete walls, if you'd like to call them that, with these high explosive bombs to get through to damage the submarine pens. Well, of course, there's no way of finding out. We know that from the aiming point photographs that we saw subsequently that we hit the target, but there's no way to tell how many submarines were destroyed in that particular raid.
Presumably these places were protected, they were important sites to the enemy, and any plane flying over was likely to receive maximum
that's right.
defense.
Yes.
So for a young chap on the base realizing where he's going, how did that affect the individual? How did that affect the atmosphere on base, do you think, when it was known where one was going?
Well, you had very little time, because once you knew your target and you'd received your briefing, and your navigator and bomb aimer had received their briefing, you were then put in a transport and taken out to your aircraft, so that you really had no time to talk about it until you got into the aircraft, and then there was a little bit of feedback between members of the crew as their thoughts on that subject. And I must confess that I think because they're also conscientious, young conscientious people, that they realised that they'd have to give of their absolute best to survive. They relied, of course, on the pilot to get them there and back, but I think they were very aware of the possible consequences, but as I hope they were, like myself, confident and not overconfident.